Third hour on this Wednesday afternoon, Darren, Donick, and Chase. And sad, another legendary name and coach in the SEC has left us. It was Pat Dye earlier in the week, and now you can add Johnny Majors to the list, who was certainly a legendary player and coach. And our next guest, I thought his quote was pretty much sums it up. When you think Johnny Majors, that name, it's synonymous with Tennessee football. And Jimmy Himes now joins us. He's afternoon host on Sports Animal, WNML, there in Knoxville. Jimmy, thanks for joining us. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, guys. I hope you are as well.
Yep. Thanks for doing this. I don't think there's anybody in that market that knew Johnny Majors better than you. So just kind of take us down memory lane. I'll turn it over to you because you knew him best.
Well, I had a great relationship with him, and I've told people I can't think of any coaches that I enjoyed covering more than John Majors. He was very honest. He was very open. He was colorful. He was a great storyteller. I love going to practice and watching him practice and his interaction with players and coaches, although I will tell you, he was tough to play for and he was tough to coach for, no doubt about that. But I enjoyed that. Our relationship continued to evolve. When he left to go to Pitt and then came back, he started having monthly luncheons in Knoxville. I spoke at a couple of them. I attended many of them. We had a chance to play golf a few times together, and I really got pretty close to him. And the thing that kind of stands out to me when I heard the news this morning is that, and I called him now and then just to check on him, how you doing? I happened to call him May 21st. And he said, you know, this is my birthday. I said, no, I didn't know it was your birthday. He said, yeah. He said, I've turned 85 today. He said, I never thought I'd live to be 60. And I thought, well, I'm glad you made it to 85. But the last thing he said was, hey, we're going to go have lunch when this virus thing clears up. And I'm going to hold it to you. You have to call me. So don't you forget, we're going to go have lunch. Well, we didn't get a chance to do that, but when I think of Majors, as you said it earlier, I think of that name being synonymous with Tennessee football. He was a great player at Tennessee. Should have won the Heisman Trophy. He was a great coach at Tennessee. And I think he should be in the Hall of Fame as a coach as well, because he rebuilt three programs. And the thing to hold against him is that if you didn't win 60% of your games, you don't get to go in the Hall of Fame. Well, that's ridiculous if you took over at Iowa State and Pitt and the problem that they had. And then you came back to try to rebuild Tennessee, and it took a while. But I just thought, and the other thing about Majors is he wasn't a football one-track mind coach. He liked the symphony. He liked history. He liked reading. He liked traveling. He had a lot of interest. And I always thought he was great in dealing with the fan base when he was out signing autographs and meeting folks. I always thought he did a great job of representing Tennessee in that fashion.
Majors led Pittsburgh to a national championship in an undefeated season in 1976. He obviously endured a lot of success at Tennessee. We had Kevin Skarbinski on yesterday telling us stories about Pat Dye and what made him so successful. So I'll ask you the same thing. Since you were close to Majors, just like he was close to Dye, what made Johnny Majors a successful? Why did it work? What made him so successful?
One, I think he was a great teacher. Secondly, in regard to that, I think that he knew football very well because he played both ways in college. Very good defensive back, played kind of like quarterback position in the wing tee. He also was a punter, so he did everything on the football field, and I think that allowed him also to be a really good teacher. The other thing is he paid attention to details. If he saw a receiver not running the right route or an offensive lineman taking the wrong step, he would jump in there and make sure they did it the right way. He also demanded excellence. Now, sometimes, and he and I discussed this, but sometimes I thought he went a little bit too far, in particular with his assistant coaches. There was a time later that he acknowledged to me, yeah, there were a couple of them. I did go a little bit too far with my demanding excellence. But he said, I'm not going to apologize for demanding excellence from my assistant coaches or my players. And I think that's what it was. No detail unturned, his knowledge of the game, his ability to teach, and demanding excellence.
Jimmy, did the relationship between Philip Fulmer and Johnny Majors get any better over the years?
Not really. And it kind of saddened me in that regard, but John Majors never got over the situation. He felt like Philip Fulmer did some untoward things in terms of getting his job, and he never forgave Fulmer for that. I do know that Philip Fulmer reached out to Coach Majors a number of times trying to smooth things over, and Coach Majors wasn't interested in that, and that's a shame. But I hated that because it left the Vol Nation, many people in the Vol Nation, split. Some were Majors guys, some were former guys, and you really don't want that. Two of the three best coaches in your program's history weren't getting along, and I did not think that was healthy for Tennessee sports.
Talking to Jimmy Hyams, great perspective on the life of Coach Johnny Majors, who passed away at age 85 today. And Jimmy, let's go back to the chapter of him as a player, because maybe some fans, it's a little more fresh in their mind, his history as the coach at Tennessee, but he was a tremendous player, and a lot of people thought he maybe should have won the Heisman Trophy back in the day.
Yeah, he was known as the Huntland Hornet, and so he weighed about 140 pounds. And so the coach that recruited him to Tennessee told Nealon that he weighed 160. So basically he lied to him. And so anyway, so Majors gets up there, and I think Nealon looks at him like, wait a minute, this guy doesn't look like he weighs that much. But he got out there, and he was able to make a lot of people miss him because he was very quick and had good moves, very elusive. And so he realized, he called the family back after early practice as a freshman and said, hey, I can play at this level. So he goes on to be a star player. 1956, he leads the team to an undefeated regular season and loses a Heisman to Paul Hornung. Paul Hornung was playing at Notre Dame, and he was on a 2-18. The great story about that is that Gus Manning was the sports information director at Tennessee at that time. And so John Majors used to get on Gus Manning about, how in the world did you let somebody from a losing team beat me out when I did all this and I was on under 15? So Majors accused Gus Manning of buying mint juleps to Paul Hornung when they'd go to the Kentucky Derby. And Gus Manning didn't deny that. So anyway, Majors was getting on Gus about how in the world did you let that guy beat me out for the Heisman Trophy and I finished second? And Gus said, I had to work like hell to get you into second place. So that's kind of the relationship they had. But Majors was a tremendous player. I thought he'd be a really good NFL player. I'm not sure exactly all the reasons. I know he was very small. That probably contributed to it. But as a player, he was very hard to tackle. He was a decent passer. He could punt. And he was very smart, had great knowledge of the game. And I think all those things, with that versatility, allowed him to be a great college football player.
Well, you know, it's interesting as you look, you know, you think back to the 1970s, Tony Dorsett, undefeated team for Pittsburgh, and then he comes back to his alma mater. And Jimmy, it had to be interesting to watch. You know, it's always tricky sometimes, I think maybe more tricky than people would believe, when you come home. Basically, and you coach your alma mater, if you're not winning big, there's a lot of pressure. And it took a couple years before he really got his teams cranked up at Tennessee with the kind of success. It didn't happen overnight.
No, it didn't. And in fact, there was a lot of discussion. If he'd been coaching now and come back to Tennessee, he'd have been fired after 3 or 4 years. They weren't very good. It took him a long time to rebuild it. Bill Battle, and he's a great man, but he'd kind of let the program slide. They had not done well in recruiting, so the cupboard was really bare. And there were a couple of really good wins along the way, upset Notre Dame in like 1979, but they didn't really, and they beat Alabama and snapped an 11-game losing streak in 1982. But the 82, 83, 84 teams were pretty good, not great, but pretty good. And people were just getting really impatient about, when's this thing going to turn around? Because Tennessee hadn't won the SEC since 1969. At that time, it was the longest drought in program history. But then comes the 1985 season, and Tony Robinson's a great quarterback. They have a great start. The only loss is to Florida in the first half of the year. Robinson goes down against Alabama. Darrell Dickey, the AD son, comes in, takes over quarterback, and manages them to I think they've won tie, and they won the rest of their games, including the big win over Miami. And, boy, when they beat Miami and they went down to the Sugar Bowl, that was an incredible scene to see that. But that's when it really got turned around. And so Majors won the SEC in 85, 89, and 90. Those were his 3 years to win the SEC. but it did take a long time to get it turned around, in large part because he inherited just a bare cupboard of talent when he got to Tennessee.
Jimmy, I always will remember that win over Vinny Testaverde and company, that great Miami team under Jimmy Johnson. Would you say that that was his biggest win as the coach of Tennessee? As you mentioned, they won a lot of games after, and they became much more consistent, and the foundation was built for when Philip Fulmer took over, where they really got to the top almost year in and year out during the 90s. But I felt like that was a huge tipping point when they were able to beat Miami on such a big stage in that Sugar Bowl.
100%. That was enormous. It was a great Miami team. That Miami team ended up putting 21 players in the NFL. I think everybody on offense and defense made it except for one guy. I bet that guy felt pretty bad. But, yeah, they were unreal. Vinny Testaverde would win the Heisman Trophy the next year. Jimmy Johnson, the coach, when he was at New Orleans, and I'm paraphrasing, basically said, it's not a matter of whether we're going to beat Tennessee, it's by how much. And Miami was in the national championship picture, and if they had a big win over Tennessee, they could win the national title. Well, Tennessee comes in as a decide. They're only like an 8-point underdog, but nobody really gave much of a chance to win the game. And then they end up blowing out Miami 35-7. They had an incredible defensive game plan to confuse Testaverde. And so they wiped Miami off the map. And I'm telling you, and I was at that game, there must have been 60 to 65,000 Tennessee fans in the Superdome. You couldn't hardly find a Miami fan. And by the second half, they were all gone anyway. But it was an incredible sea of orange. They also dominated the French Quarter. If you went to a restaurant, they're serving beignets. Everybody was eating a beignet was dressed in orange. It was just amazing the way Tennessee took over New Orleans and the Superdome that night. And I thought that, to me, I still, when I look back at it, and I know Tennessee won a national championship out in Tempe, but it's hard for me to look at a better moment in Tennessee football in all the years I've covered them than the night they beat Miami in the Sugar Bowl.
We're talking to Jimmy Himes, who has covered the Vols for a long time and just radio, of course, for the Sports Animal, WNML in Knoxville. And Jimmy, as I sit here listening to these stories, obviously I'm the young pup on the show, so I don't remember Coach Major's time in Knoxville. I was very, very young when he left, and a lot of my memories as a kid is with Philip Fulmer. So I bring that up to ask somebody my age, 33, that needs to know something about Johnny Majors and his time that hasn't already been said. What is something that a young for a Vols fan or a non-Vols fan that they need to know?
Wow, that's a great question. It's hard to answer what they might not know. I do think when you look at the Majors family, when you look at the fact that he had two or three brothers that played at Tennessee, and his brother Bobby was an All-American player at Tennessee. They were just ingrained in Tennessee. The one thing about him, I touched on this earlier, but he was well-rounded. He loved to travel, read books, loved the symphony, loved history. And when he came back to Tennessee from Pittsburgh after his four-year stint there, he started a monthly lunch club. And I attended it. I spoke at it. And it was a lot of fun, but he would have a wide range of guests. It wasn't just football guests. It wasn't just sports guests. He would have somebody that might have been a general in a war, or somebody that had some history knowledge of some event, and he would have people from the symphony over there. He just had a wide range of guests that he would bring by there, and that was the thing about him that a lot of people might not have realized was how diverse he was. Maybe I'm wrong, but when I look at somebody like Nick Saban, I think football 100% of the time. But Majors wasn't like that. He loved football, coached it, but he also had a lot of interest outside of football, which I thought made him unique. And also, he was a great personality. He loved to get out and mix and mingle with people, and he certainly appreciated the fan base that he had, because I witnessed many times when he would sign autograph after autograph after autograph and never complain about it. He just did it because he felt like that was part of his obligation.
Jimmy, of course, we talked about his relationship, or lack of relationship, I guess I should say, with Philip Fulmer. But what was it like with some of the other coaches, whether it was Lane Kiffin for the year or Butch Jones, Derek Dooley, and, of course, Jeremy Pruitt now? Did he have any type of relationship with those coaches?
Yes, every one of them. And, in fact, Lane Kiffin really embraced him. And that's the first time I remember him, Majors, going back to practice, and that was in 2009. And then Butch Jones did it. Derek Dooley did it. Butch Jones did it. Jeremy Pruitt did it. And so, yeah, they reached out, had him come to practice. He was welcomed in the press box. He was welcomed at a variety of events over there. And so and that was good. That needed to happen. Even if there was a rift between him and the AD, that needed to happen. And through a lot of that time, Philip Fulmer wasn't around. So, I thought that was a good situation. One thing that was kind of funny was when Majors came back, he felt like the entire campus was his personal parking lot. So he parked illegally on a street named Johnny Majors Boulevard, and he got a ticket. And so one of the administrators in the athletic department said, we can't give him a ticket for parking on his boulevard. So they ripped up the ticket so he wouldn't have to pay for it. But just stuff like that. He illegally parked another time on the street, and people didn't know who it was. So he started honking at him, like, what are you doing? You know, get out of the way. So he thought they recognized him. So he gets out of the car, and he's waving at all of them. Hey, thank you, you know. And they're all mad at him for parking illegally because they couldn't get around him. So he was a character, but he was just a lot of fun to be with. And I really, really did appreciate my relationship with him.
Man, those are great stories. Jimmy Himes is with us. Jimmy, I can tell. You know, I start thinking back. I try to put myself in his shoes, you know, the competitor that he was. He had the great success at Pittsburgh. It didn't end the way he wanted to when he was coaching Tennessee. But the going back to Pittsburgh, you know, he never had much success there. Do you think he realized how tough of a challenge it was going to be? The program was in such a different place when he went back for a second time.
I think he realized it, but I think it was also harder than he thought. But he was not going to be. One of the things that happened when he went to Pitt the first time, and they were awful. If they weren't 0-11, they were 1-10. They were just terrible when he got there. But at that time, he could go out and sign almost an unlimited amount. I think he may have signed 80-something players his first year at Pitt. One of them happened to be Tony Dorsett. But he loaded the boat with all these recruits, and it ticked off Joe Paterno at Penn State because he thought there was a unspoken rule that you couldn't sign more than about 45. Well, going back to Pitt the second time around, there were recruiting restrictions, and the program had fallen off again. The facilities were no good. I actually went up there to do a story about it, and it was awful. And it was a monumental challenge to get that thing turned around. And I think if he gave him some truth serum, he kind of wishes maybe he hadn't done that. But he felt like he still had some good years in coaching left. He was in his 50s. He was still in his 50s, and I think he wanted to kind of prove that he still had it. But going back to Pittsburgh was just too much of a task to get that thing turned around. And to some people, it diminished his legacy a little bit, but I don't feel that way. I think that's a little bit unfair just because I know how difficult of a job it would have been to turn that program around at that time. One funny story about that when I went up there. So I was talking to him during this long feature piece, and I said, where'd you go? He said, well, I went to an auction. And I said, did you get anything? He said, yeah, I got auction. He said, I bid on this item. I got free gas for a year for my company vehicle. And he said, and then I realized the mistake I made. I said, what was the mistake? He said, they gave me free gas, so I didn't have to buy it. So I wasted all this money buying free gas for a year, and the university provided it for me.
That is fantastic. By the way, one year we were doing a player show at Cool Springs Galleria, and the player guest that night was Albert Hainsworth, and he was late to the show. We couldn't figure out why. It's because he had also parked illegally, and he was trying to talk himself out of getting that ticket. I think he ended up doing that. He had to move the car, but he was late to the show because of that. Jimmy, great stuff. Really appreciate it. That was fantastic stories, and we appreciate the visit today. Thanks for doing this.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me, and you guys have a great afternoon.
You do the same. That is Jimmy Himes, afternoon host there on WNML, the Sports Animal in Knoxville. He's been in that market for a long time, and as you can tell, had an unbelievable relationship with Johnny Majors, dead today at age 85. We will come back more of Darren Donick and Chase on ESPN 102.5 The Game.